The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Greetings, everyone. I'm Jennifer Green for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Teen Magazines. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from theteenmagazine.com and teenvogue.com. Our first article today, from theteenmagazine.com, Talk of the Ton, Bridgerton's Incomparable South Asian Representation. And this article was written by Toshani Dutta. Extravagant gowns, impeccable dialogue, and longing gazes. Netflix's Bridgerton has brought with it a completely new audience finding themselves pining for that Regency-era-like romance for their own life story. From intricate storylines and complex characters interweaving the tantalizing love stories, of course, the loosely book-based adaptation has certainly taken from the old, but has made seamless space for the new, too. For starters, our recent protagonists, like Kate and Edwina Sharma, as well as Queen Charlotte herself in the most recent edition of the series, bring an unexpected delight and depth to the plot by not only being women from different backgrounds, but also showing how these differences would play out in a time where it would have been both geographically and historically impossible. But why does the show's casting choice matter so much anyway? Misrepresentation is the bane of my existence. There's always been discourse on representation in Hollywood, whether it's about gender, race, culture, sexuality, or background, and now it's no longer about whether we are indulged when we ask for a glimpse of interesting characters from all over the world on screen, but how these characters are portrayed and constructed instead. In a world which has Liz's spiritual awakening in Eat, Pray, Love, 2012, and Kelly Kapoor from The Office, 2005 onwards, to Kingo of The Eternals, 2021, and a plethora of other side characters who have flirted with being comic reliefs, exotic Bollywood caricatures, cheesy plot devices, and nerdy disliked outcasts, the Sharma sisters seem to be a breath of fresh air. Here, we get to meet two multidimensional characters with their own thoughtfully constructed character arcs, who have been given the opportunity to acknowledge their heritage whenever natural, and are dark-skinned, which even Bollywood is taking long enough to celebrate. And the best thing about them is they get to make mistakes, whether it's Kate figuring out that she cannot project her own desires on her sister, or Edwina herself taking charge of her story, like during the confrontation. The core of Bridgerton still remains the fantasy and scandal, which the characters constantly navigate, but with it, they quench the stubborn drought of inclusion in cinema today. When talking to The Telegraph, Charithra Chandran, who plays Edwina, expresses, "I think that Bridgerton has done for TV what Hamilton did for theater," she said. "It encouraged a totally different audience to watch period drama and romances, and it made us feel seen on screen. Sip tea with scandal, not scam." The creators of Bridgerton, notably Shonda Rhimes herself, have a flair for mastering a delicate balancing act of plot and storyline and diverse portrayals. Kate and Edwina's place in the story doesn't seem forced. Yet, their backstory makes sense and gives them adequate meaning and motive for their actions. And through it all, they don't have to fall back on the helpless maiden trope and stand alone as strong female characters. When I watched the first season of Bridgerton, I didn't even realize how important South Asian representation is till its successor. I found aspects of my life in the Sharma family, from the small Bangla phrases they use to the Haldi ritual before Edwina's big day. Through a critical lens, all these nods to Indian culture weren't exactly culturally accurate, mixing quite a few traits and characteristics from vastly different parts of the country. But I think I speak for many when I say I relished whatever I could get. What's next for the Ton? Bridgerton has increased my expectations of seeing myself reflected on screen, And the industry does seem to give me hope, too. From the last season of Never Have I Ever being released, to catching a glimpse of Pavitra Prabhakar in Spider-Man Across the Universe, our main characters on screen are so much more emotionally rounded while being entertaining and connecting with audiences, even those not Indian, while having a central role in the plot. One thing remains common throughout this cinematic revolution of brown representation. Having South Asians in the writer's room and director's seat directly translates to incomparable representation on screen as well. Our next article from theteenmagazine.com. Why Legacy Admissions at Top Universities Needs to End. And this article was written by Minhozu Mahmud. Following the Supreme Court's ruling against race-conscious admission to universities in June this year, attention has now turned to another long-standing practice, legacy admissions. This policy refers to a preference given to applicants related to an alumnus, usually a parent or a grandparent. The process is considered to provide certain students a competitive advantage, so its continued use remains controversial. How it all started. Legacy admissions was first introduced in the United States in the 1920s. At that time, universities saw a significant rise in applicants from ethnic backgrounds as a wave of immigrants entered the country. As immigrant students became increasingly qualified, elite schools needed to find a way to retain places for wealthy Protestant students. Through the legacy admissions process, these highly prestigious schools could favor relatives of alumni to maintain spaces for white, middle-class students successfully. Highly prestigious Ivy League college Dartmouth, ranked 13th in the U.S. in 2022, was the first to implement a legacy admission policy in 1922. Along with many other esteemed colleges, including Harvard and Yale, Dartmouth continues to accept students in this way 100 years later. Today, statistics show that the share of legacy students in Ivy League schools in the class of 2023 ranges from 12 to 16.7%. A recent study showed that these applicants are nearly four times more likely to be accepted despite equal test scores as their peers. Lately, legacy admissions have received heavy criticism as more speak out for their abolishment. Recently, the Supreme Court decided to end affirmative action after 50 years of the policy's use in college admissions. Affirmative action aims to tackle the underrepresentation of ethnic minority students in U.S. colleges, particularly highly prestigious ones. However, the justices deemed the policy unconstitutional, arguing that it created a racially discriminatory admissions process. So, if affirmative action has been overruled on these grounds, legacy admissions should be too. Some argue that there is an even stronger case for abolishing legacy admissions than for affirmative action. Legacy admission is determined to promote a more racially diverse student population by favoring students from underrepresented backgrounds. On the contrary, legacy admissions will only benefit those already advantaged, wealthy applicants. While affirmative action may be discriminatory, its purpose benefits society by promoting equal access to education. Legacy admissions, on the other hand, may be seen as both discriminatory and exacerbating educational inequality. Why do legacy admissions still exist? One reason legacy admissions persist is that most students come from wealthy backgrounds, so they do not require university financial aid. Furthermore, alumni often give large and frequent donations. Admitting relatives likely increases financial contributions. This hugely benefits colleges, who can now reinvest the significant sums of money to improve student facilities. Some have also argued that legacy admissions help build community within the college. Through having alumni relatives, legacy students share a strong common ground, which could create a better connection between students. It is also believed that using a legacy admission policy is an effective way to choose between students whose applications display similar achievements and capabilities. In this case, legacy students are almost always favored as colleges feel they have a stronger affinity to the school's history and values. However, critics have disputed that it is highly unlikely to have identically accomplished applicants. Finally, giving preferential acceptance has not proved disadvantageous to college exam results. Legacy students still receive outstanding grades, so admitting them does not damage college rankings or their reputation for educational success. Why should legacy admissions end? One of the main reasons legacy admissions should be abolished is that their existence supports flawed values for current and prospective students. Colleges should espouse the correct message that dedicated students who work hard will be rewarded, and that their background or financial status will neither help nor hinder them. This is akin to the American dream, where everyone has an equal opportunity for success and can accomplish any aspiration with enough perseverance. The legacy admission policy undermines these national values, long cherished by America. Attaining access to a higher level of education, which could potentially be life-changing, should not be based on the circumstances one is born into. If actions speak louder than words, what message are U.S. colleges sending out by continuing to use this openly preferential admissions system? Online statistics on acceptance rates alone are enough to convey the exceeding difficulty of getting into an Ivy League college. Acceptance is not guaranteed, even with outstanding grades, high SAT scores, and flattering letters of recommendation. Acceptance could feel like an impossibility for students with no familial connections to the school. In addition to competing with thousands of accomplished applicants, these students must also contend with the significant advantage of an alumni connection. In this way, legacy admissions could easily prove demotivating. This means legacy admissions could be detrimental to students if they lose self-belief in their potential, which is not ideal for society. Finally, the continued use of legacy admissions could widen social inequalities, with those from less connected backgrounds facing an even greater challenge for acceptance. Legacy admissions is like the domino effect. An education at an Ivy League school gives a solid competitive edge in the job market, meaning good jobs post-graduation with ample opportunity for promotion. With significantly larger salaries in the long term, more fulfilling lifestyles can be enjoyed. Those who cannot include a distinguished school on their resume may find competing for highly sought-after jobs more challenging. In this way, legacy admissions may affect entire lives and generations, harming society through its potential to lower social mobility. So what now? Following the Supreme Court's announcement on affirmative action, the U.S. Department of Education opened an inquiry into Harvard's legacy admissions policies filed on behalf of Black and Latino community groups in New England. Unfortunately, more individuals, civil rights groups, and activists will likely need to take legal steps against elite colleges. This route may be inevitable to move toward a universal, merit-based system for college admissions. In recent years, prestigious universities, including Amherst College, Carnegie Mellon University, and Johns Hopkins University, have eliminated legacy admissions. Other schools have been doing the same since the Supreme Court ruling. In addition, this summer, Colorado passed a state law banning the practice at all public colleges and universities, a sign that U.S. states may be hastening to accelerate this development. This is all good news. As further light and debate ensue around this practice and its startling statistics, it is clear that ending legacy admissions for all schools will be an essential step toward equal access to a college education. By leveling the playing field, acceptance into prestigious schools will become an achievable ambition for any student. Our next article from theteenmagazine.com. What have we learned from the COVID-19 pandemic? And this article was written by Aryan Garg. The coronavirus SARS-CoV-2, which causes the COVID-19 disease, had taken our world by storm through the end of 2019 and throughout 2020. This virus was seemingly more dangerous and widespread than any other, and we were forced to shelter in our homes. This virus did not care about countries, boundaries, and demographics. It ended up crippling economies, shutting down small businesses and even larger companies, straining healthcare systems, causing supply chain and job disruptions, and worst of all, claiming the lives of over 7 million people. History has shown us that it repeats itself in a cycle. With major pandemics or disease outbreaks occurring every 100 years, including the plague, cholera, and Spanish flu, it is high time we start learning from our mistakes. Countries need to have protocols to handle diseases to protect people and manage other health-related crises. Some of the most significant issues that I will talk about are accurate and unbiased information being given to the public, having a surplus of medical supplies and essential food/equipment, allowing legislation to be passed quicker, and the role people can individually play. The earliest response came from institutions that required masks, gloves, and social distancing, depending on the location. Initially, most people didn't know much about the virus, and it started gaining traction after countries like China, Italy, and others in Europe started introducing lockdowns. Hospitals began to become overloaded in urban areas, and city/state governments in the U.S. introduced testing and tracing measures and some lockdowns. As COVID kept spreading, it became clear that testing and tracing would not stop this issue. So, many jobs switched to online formats, non-essential businesses closed temporarily, there were travel restrictions, and they implemented curfews/lockdowns. This situation has profoundly impacted people's mental health, as it forced them to remain in a confined space and prevented them from engaging in person with friends and the individuals they were accustomed to seeing regularly. There seemed to be no end, especially for students who had graduation canceled or school interrupted. Most schools stayed entirely online for about a year until companies such as Pfizer, Moderna, and Johnson & Johnson in the U.S. introduced a vaccine. Depending on the location, this lets students go back to school with vaccination, mask, and social distancing requirements. The pandemic underscored the critical importance of having robust healthcare systems with sufficient hospital capacity and resource management. Considering we're in the digital age, looking into telemedicine and non-traditional healthcare is even more critical now. Of course, the pandemic was generally a negative thing. Still, it brought up a lot of vulnerabilities for countries in their policy, which I think needs to be fixed. Every country should have an action plan for different classifications of diseases, depending on whether they're minor epidemics or major pandemics. A lot of deaths could have been prevented with earlier isolation and preventative measures. This was a massive disruption, with about 8 million deaths and 700 million cases. However, we learned how to use mRNA vaccines and data analytics in healthcare, which will be very useful the next time we face something like this. Researchers and public health officials used data analytics to create models that helped forecast the trajectory of the pandemic, which helped make policy decisions and allocate resources to the demographics and regions that needed it most. Companies like Pfizer and Moderna utilized the power of mRNA technology to develop vaccines in record time. They compressed the traditional vaccine development processes, which used to take years, into months without compromising safety or efficacy. One of the main things that happened was students had to stay at home, and parents stayed at home to work unless they were considered essential employees. This took a significant toll on children. They had a worse education, less social interaction, and it seemed like they were living under a rock. Mental health was a huge problem, as people were concerned for their own safety and the safety of their relatives, mostly older relatives. Also, social interactions are fundamental to a healthy mental state, and all that was taken away. Canceled or limited in-person therapy sessions overwhelmed healthcare systems and increased demand for mental health services left many young individuals without adequate access to help. It was much harder to prioritize things beside COVID during the pandemic, and it seems like we never fully fixed the problems that COVID-19 caused, but rather we moved on. Parents, educators, and policymakers must prioritize the mental health of young individuals and provide them with the necessary support and resources. By addressing their unique challenges and creating a safe and nurturing environment, we can help reduce the long-term effects of poor mental health. Poor mental health can result in many problems, like violence, not to mention the impact on extracurricular activities. The closure of schools also meant the suspension of in-person interactions with peers and teachers, as well as the cancellation of extracurricular activities. These students then had to turn to their computers or phones for a source of entertainment or just to pass the time. A lot of the time, doing so resulted in being influenced by everything they saw online. This includes news, any information spread by others, and especially social media. These media sources were very damaging for people, especially young students, since their minds are vulnerable to outside influences. This news overstated COVID-19 and made it the number one priority for everyone, even when not necessarily so. For example, much COVID-19 vaccination information was inaccurate, which botched studies or biases. Many cases and death counts may have been inflated due to COVID not being identified as a primary cause of death. All of this controversy led to more and more worry. Acknowledging that COVID-19 led to many of these problems, we can start addressing them properly. Our next article from TeenVogue.com. Dylan Mulvaney honored with Suicide Prevention Advocate of the Year Award. And this article was written by Ashley Carter. Dylan Mulvaney's influence has extended beyond her TikToks or performance on the Broadway stage, which is why the Trevor Project has honored her with the Suicide Prevention Advocate of the Year Award. The Trevor Project, which is a nonprofit dedicated to providing crisis services for LGBTQ+ youth, has given the award to two other people, Janelle Monáe in 2022 and Lil Nas X in 2021. The award is given to influential people who champion the LGBTQ community and advocate for mental health awareness. I am deeply honored to accept the Trevor Project's Suicide Prevention Advocate of the Year Award, Mulvaney said in a statement. Trevor's life-saving work holds a special place in my heart because it represents a lifeline for so many who are struggling with their identity and may not feel accepted as their authentic self. Mulvaney continued, "To anyone feeling lost or scared, I want you to know that you are so incredibly loved, and there is light after the moments of darkness. Always remember that you are never alone. You are perfect just the way you are, and organizations like the Trevor Project are here to provide a safe space to talk whenever you need, 24/7. The organization said that Mulvaney's TikTok series, Days of Girlhood, which chronicled her journey as a trans woman, caused her to emerge as a beacon of trans joy, positivity, and inspiration for the LGBTQ community, the Trevor Project wrote. Over the past year, Dylan has consistently utilized their large platform to educate audiences on gender identity and the trans experience, raise awareness around LGBTQ issues, and redefine what true allyship looks like, the organization continued. Mulvaney, 26, has worked with the Trevor Project extensively and in March raised more than $200,000 for the nonprofit during their Day 365 Live cabaret show at the Rainbow Room in New York City. "This award stands for all of us," Mulvaney continued. "Let's continue to work together to uplift and empower LGBTQ young people and create a world where no young person ever feels that hope is out of reach." Mulvaney has endured a successful but tumultuous year after being the center of transphobic vitriol following her partnership with Bud Light. The actor was targeted by anti-trans groups who vowed to boycott the American beer brand over their collaboration with Mulvaney. After keeping quiet about the situation for several weeks, Mulvaney spoke out and said they didn't even feel part of the conversation. "I'm sitting with my emotions, you know, not reacting, waiting to respond," Mulvaney said at the time. "I've been having crazy deja vu because I'm an adult. I'm 26, and throughout childhood, I was called too feminine and over the top. And here I am, not being called all those same things, but this time it's from other adults." The Trevor Project reports that 41% of young LGBTQ+ people seriously considered attempting suicide in the past year, including half of transgender and non-binary young people, according to its 2023 U.S. National Survey on the Mental Health of LGBTQ Young People. The organization said that the increase in anti-LGBTQ+ policies has also played a role in young people's mental health. We've run out of time for today's episode of Teen Magazines. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jennifer Green, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Teen Magazines is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. We thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.